So welcome again to the Greg Kelly podcast. Folks, we are off to an amazing start. We thank you very, very much. Some quick admin notes while I have your attention. We'd love for you to subscribe to the show. If you want, just go to click subscribe and then also download the show. So much appreciated. It's free. And we love hearing from you guys as well in the reviews. And feel free to email us as well. Go check it out. Subscribe, download, review, and rate. And thank you very, very much for that. Ladies and gentlemen, today we have with us Dick Morris, the legendary political strategist and advisor. He has worked for Republicans, and perhaps most famously, he worked for Democrat Bill Clinton, helped make him governor of Arkansas back in 1978, when I think Bill Clinton was just 32 years old or so, something like that, and they started talking about him as a future president. What else? He famously helped get him reelected, advising him, managing his campaign back in 1996 when it looked like Bill Clinton was political dead meat, certainly after 1994. I've gotten to know Dick Morris through my broadcast on Newsmax. He is brilliant, very, very entertaining. And you can go to dickmorris.com to see his videos and essays, which are he's telling us things that no one else is talking about, and I think it's very, very important. Dick Morris, welcome, and how are you?
Hey, Greg. It's great. I've really sort of we've discovered each other through Newsmax. I love being interviewed by you, and you apparently like me to interview. And it's a relationship made in heaven.
Well, Dick, it is a privilege to talk to you now and on television. I've, you know, heard of you for many, many years prior, and now that to talk to you is a privilege. And so, Dick, where are we right now? It's Sunday. It's the weekend of, what date is today? November 21st.
21st, yeah.
The mainstream media says it's looking very, very bleak for Donald Trump. Now, I can't articulate why. I don't know the mechanics like you do. I have this immense feeling that Donald Trump will ultimately prevail. I don't know exactly how that's going to happen, but I just feel this force of nature cannot be stopped by Joe Biden. Dick, on the other hand, has concrete information and knowledge about how this may go the president's way. So, Dick, what are you thinking about right now? First of all, you do believe there's a lot of hope for Donald Trump's cause?
Oh, I do. I do, absolutely. I'm not sure I'm willing to predict that it's going to come out, but he has a hell of a fighting chance. It depends in large part on the intestinal fortitude of the Supreme Court. But we'll see.
One thing you said on one of your recent videos, that the Democrats have actually been planning this kind of vote-taking operation for 2 years. 2 years they've had it in mind that they could possibly steal an election. Can you talk about that, please?
Yeah. In 2000, Bush v. Gore, the Democrats felt outraged that Gore was defeated. And they decided that it was all the fault of Harris. I think it's Kathleen Harris, the Secretary of State of Florida. So they resolved to go out and win Secretary of State elections in all swing states. And in 2014, a group was set up called iVote, which is nominally is designed to fight voter suppression and help minorities be sure that they can vote. But in fact, was designed to take over Secretary of State races. Because those are the people in each state, 40 of the 50 states, including all the swing states, who decide who votes and who doesn't. It's reminiscent of Joseph Stalin's famous quote, "It doesn't matter who casts the votes, it matters who counts the votes." And they got that, and they really focused on it. And in 2018, in Michigan and in Arizona, they defeated Republican incumbent secretaries of state and elected Democrats instead, who were radical, way-out, leftist, Marxist Democrats, and assuring that there would be election fraud in those states and that they could steal the election. All that's happened now is simply the unfolding fruition of that plan. And the secretaries of state have the power to appoint the inspectors who take the votes, the canvassers who count them, the rules under which the votes are cast, most famously in Michigan, the Secretary of State, a woman named Benson, sent out 7.7 million absentee ballots to everybody in the state, including some dead people. And that assured that the election would be swamped with fraudulent ballots.
I've noticed her. Jocelyn Benson is her name. She seems a bit too giddy. She struck me as very, very political before the election. And by the way, like, why? It's an interesting job that I think a lot of folks don't know about, a Secretary of State of a state. And the functions that you just listed, it seems like they would be better served, I don't know, by civil servants, perhaps. It just sounds like a very, to me, corruptible position. I mean, why would anybody want to be the Secretary of State?
Well, people used to want to be it because it was kind of a stepping stone to being senator or governor. It was a statewide election, and if you could win that, you presumably could get name recognition and run for something big. But now it has a totally different level. In the past, the informal duties of the Secretary of State aren't much. They certify corporations, they keep public records and stuff like that. But the duty of overseeing the elections was normally just taken as a given, not particularly controversial. But now that the Democrats are determined to totally alter our democracy, to institutionalize the stealing of elections, it becomes very important that they control those jobs.
So you mentioned that, or actually we haven't talked about it yet, but something very significant has happened in the past day or so. Regarding the Supreme Court and the states they're responsible for. What's that all about?
First of all, you have to, just as an overview, see this as a three-act play. Act one was when the votes were counted and recounted. Act two is when we sued in state court. And act three is when it gets to federal court. And we were clobbered in act one. We never had expected a good outcome in Act Two because those are all Democratic judges. But we have a great opportunity to prevail in the federal courts. And crucial to those courts are the circuit courts of appeals. In the federal structure, there's the Supreme Court on top. Next is the circuit court. There are 11 circuit court districts covering the whole country. And then below that are the district courts. There are about 600 of those. And those have one judge each. The circuit courts have, I think, 9 or 10 judges, and they handle matters before they get to the Supreme Court. And they really can determine if a matter gets to the Supreme Court in the first place. And they handle motion practice. So for example, when Republicans thought that correctly that they were being banned from looking at the votes in Pennsylvania, they went to Judge Alito. Not the whole court, but Judge Alito, because he was in charge of that circuit. And he issued the order that Republicans had to be present. And then he reissued it again later in that week. And that position is very important. Now, because Barrett just joined the Supreme Court yesterday, they assigned the circuit's assignments for the coming term and probably for the near future. And they gave Barrett the Seventh Circuit, which oversees Wisconsin. They gave Kavanaugh the Eighth Circuit that oversees Michigan. Alito kept the Third Circuit that oversees Pennsylvania. And Thomas got the 11th Circuit that oversees Georgia. The only negative news is Kagan got Arizona.
Now, and, who determined that? The Chief Justice or who?
I don't know. I guess it was a discussion. Most of these people had these assignments before. Kavanaugh had the Seventh Circuit, and when Barrett joined, they gave her the Seventh, and they had Kavanaugh transfer to the Eighth Circuit. Other than that, Alito, Thomas did not change, and Kagan didn't change his assignments. So I think it was just a, you know, would you mind doing this, Brett? And he said, no, of course not.
And again, this is not to determine, they will not have sole authority as to what happens, but they will determine whether or not it gets to the Supreme Court.
No, determine is a strong word. What they'll do is they will supervise the procedural issues that happen before the case gets to the Supreme Court. Emergency issues, procedural issues, and a variety of things like that. They do not make the decision, but they're a strong, strong ally in getting the decision made. They also will be the people that the full bench of the Supreme Court will look to when there's a report of fraud in one of their states, because they're experts on their states and are deeply enmeshed in their jurisprudence. So it's a big leg up for us to have Barrett say that Wisconsin was stolen, or Kavanaugh say that Michigan was finagled, or Alito to say all kinds of stuff went on in Pennsylvania. And assigning these judges to these districts is a very, very important step.
Now,
the other step that's important to you.
Please go ahead.
Okay. Is that Rudy Giuliani, in his press conference on Thursday, I think it was, really broke new ground. And nobody understood that. They were focused on whether he sweated or not.
Right.
But the ground he broke was fascinating. Until now, we have been saying, hey, Supreme Court or feds intervene in this election because it was horribly screwed up. And the votes were fraudulent. There were absentee ballots that were counted that shouldn't have been. Signatures were not verified. In some cases, there weren't even signatures to verify. Voters were not identified, and so on and so on and so on. Well, that's a good argument, but that would largely be an argument for state courts to determine, because they have control of the election machinery. The Constitution gives the federal government no real role in overseeing federal elections. It assigns it all to the state legislatures because they were afraid that we would have a king and a dictator, and they wanted the states to be able to stop that by controlling the election machinery. But the Supreme Court does have jurisdiction over it because of the 14th Amendment that provides for equal protection of the laws. And the citizen A has to be treated just like citizen B. And that was the basis of Bush v. Gore, which got into the Supreme Court in the first place, because they said ballots counted in Broward County are being counted differently from ballots in Tallahassee, and that is the unequal protection of the laws, and therefore that there was not a uniform rule covering the ballots that encompassed all jurisdictions in Florida. Well, we have Giuliani is structuring this case to proceed in the Bush v. Gore precedent, because what he's saying is that if you lived in Philadelphia, you could vote absentee without signing the ballot. But if you lived in Harrisburg, you can't. If you lived in Philadelphia, your signature doesn't get verified. You don't even have to have a signature. But in Harrisburg, your vote wouldn't count. In Harrisburg, they'll check you if you voted absentee, and if you show up on election day, they won't let you vote. But in Philadelphia, they will. And therefore, the rules under which this election was conducted are totally different in the big Democratic cities than in the more rural and town counties, which Trump was popular in.
So,
and you see that in Wisconsin, Milwaukee and Madison on one side, Detroit and Michigan, and Atlanta and Georgia, Phoenix and Tucson in Arizona. And that idea that you go after it on an equal protection basis is a brilliant one for Rudy's. And that combined with the circuit assignment really gives us a hell of a shot before the Supreme Court.
So Giuliani outlined a federal case. And by the way, when you mentioned Giuliani in the press conference and the makeup, and I half chuckled for a moment. And it wasn't because Giuliani's makeup was an issue, which, by the way, I didn't even notice because I was watching it on a phone and primarily listening to it. But I chuckle because you're absolutely right that the media focused so much on the atmospherics and the theater of it, and not on the substance. And I felt very, very powerfully that Giuliani was at his very best that day.
Yes.
I could care less about the makeup. Most people, I don't think, in the real world saw it. So it looked
like... You like the media... The best thing you can say about it is that they're too ignorant to understand this. If you don't like the media, you can say they deliberately overlooked it because his case was so strong.
Very interesting. And I'm glad I was on the right side of that because we played it prominently that night. And by the way, I have heard this before. I wasn't the first. Actually, Mark Levin said to his audience that what the media are doing right now and promoting President-elect Biden, you know, they keep saying President-elect Biden and that all of the allegations of voter fraud debunked, no evidence, that kind of thing. They're saying that with a target audience in mind, judges, that this is, they want this to kind of, this messaging to prevail, and judges will just have to accept this as the starting point, that we have a president-elect, and is there any merit to that? You know what he's talking about?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. It's kind of like polluting the jury pool, only it's the justice pool. That's a good point. But and also, the obstacle we face in the Supreme Court is not, do we have a case? It's not, was there fraud? It's not, was equal protection denied? We're very likely to prevail on all of those cases. It's almost open and shut. The issue is remedy. What the hell do you do about it? Does the U.S. Supreme Court set aside an entire presidential election and throw out the votes in four or five states and assign it to the guy who supposedly lost? Do they order new elections in those states? Would that be constitutional, given that the Constitution provides that you have to swear in the president on January 21st and the Electoral College has to vote, I think, is on the Constitution provides in December? What's your remedy? And does the remedy suit the case? Was the stuff drastic enough to invoke that kind of a remedy? And that's the hill we have to climb.
There is something I've heard that the Trump strategy will be to take the electoral votes, not necessarily get Trump over 270, but take Biden down below 270. And then this will have to be hashed out in Congress.
The nice thing about that is that it means that the president will be determined by a Democratic body, not by the Supreme Court, the House of Representatives. And of course, the way they vote in the House is not the way they usually do. Each state gets one vote under the Constitution. And so while the Democrats control the House, albeit by 5 votes right now, we control the majority of the state delegations. If you know your history, when Aaron Burr ran for president against Thomas Jefferson, when they were on the same ticket as president and vice president, but they got an equal number of electoral votes because somebody forgot to throw away their vote, it went to the House of Representatives, and Adams had 6 states and Jefferson had 6 states, and famously Hamilton got Delaware to flip and to go for Jefferson.
So when they reported that Biden was president-elect, when the networks did a week ago yesterday, I think it was, or maybe is it 2 weeks ago? Anyway, there was no violence, as you'll recall. Trump supporters didn't take to the streets. You know that America got ready for that, boarded up their stores or whatever, and those boards remain. I do have this sense that their side will erupt if this victory is taken away from Biden.
And absolutely.
Number one, do you think there will be violence? And number two, would judges, would Congress, would people think, well, to avoid all that, we just have to go with the status quo, which would seem to be, well, the media is saying, you know, a president-elect Biden.
Yeah, I think there's a good deal of merit to that. I think that the Supreme Court is not just the body that rules on law and on facts. They are an institution, like the presidency is, like Congress is. And as an institution, they worry about their institutional popularity. All the judges serve for life. But, you know, it's a fragile institution. And you saw it the other day when Biden was running and wouldn't rule out packing the Supreme Court. And but for 2 senators that we may still not win in Georgia, probably will, he could pack the court and completely overturn everything they've done and turn it into a mockery where each time a new president comes in, he expands the court to appoint conservative or liberal judges as he sees fit, destroying the whole institution of the Supreme Court. In fact, the very power the Supreme Court has to review the constitutionality of federal laws is one that it assumed for itself under Justice Marshall. Nowhere in the Constitution do they have that authority. So they're very conscious of that. And after Bush v. Gore, they really came to understand that the court was shaken to its core. Bush v. Gore was a 7-2 vote, which seems overwhelming, but it was terrible. Everybody voted their party line. The Republicans voted for Bush, the Democrats voted for Gore. The only courageous exception was Justice White, a Democrat, voted for Bush, and I forget which Republican voted for Gore. But other than that, it was a party line vote. And it really made the Supreme Court seem like just another partisan institution, not an institution worthy of our deference or respect. So they're going to be very careful. And I think Roberts, above all, Chief Justice, is conscious that his duty is to protect the Supreme Court, not to determine the outcome of an election, not even to protect American democracy. He's in charge of making sure the Supreme Court survives.
Interesting, very interesting. I have a question about the president right now. He's been relatively quiet, active on Twitter, but we haven't seen him much in public. I actually have two theories on that. Number one, I think he needs the rest. He has this, you know, he has incredible yeah. energy, but I think it's actually a unique opportunity to get some rest. And number two, I'm thinking this, Joe Biden is also relatively low profile, certainly for a president-elect. He's not stepping in to the fray as a normal president-elect would. And here's my theory, that Donald Trump knows that there's a power vacuum right now that Joe Biden can't fill. Even under normal circumstances, Joe Biden would not be able to step in because of his limitations physically and mentally. So that somehow, it's almost like he wants to make people miss him, which I know probably sounds crazy, but he's giving people a taste of what a Joe Biden presidency would look
country.
Would
a leaderless
look,
country.
A leaderless country. Like, is that, right. do you see, is there any, am I crazy or what?
It could be. Well, you may be crazy, but this has nothing to do with it.
Fair enough.
That certainly makes some sense. But I've spoken with the president six or seven times since Election Day. You didn't put it in my resume because it's never been public, but I was very, very involved in the Trump campaign and had over 100 conversations with him in the last 6 months. I just didn't want to be public about that because no reason to add sure. my controversies to his. but in the conversations, I think part of it was depression at the beginning. He was just very upset and very sad and very melancholy. Then he kind of got over it, and he went from being sad to being mad. And he vowed to fight it, and he deployed all his resources and really skillfully mobilizing to do that. I think that part of the reason may be that he doesn't trust himself, that if he goes out there and vents his true feelings, it's going to be way, way scorchingly beyond what you want to put out there. And I think that's why he doesn't take questions at press conferences, because he doesn't want to be inflammatory, and he can't address this issue without letting his true feelings come out.
Well,
there's one other point.
Please.
I have to pause periodically to take water because of my tongue. I believe that I have urged him in my conversations with him to be much more aggressive in using the presidency, in being president, because I feel that the goal of Biden trying to talk about his cabinet appointments and everything else is to create what in court they call stare decisis, meaning what's the current state of the law. And to have it been reinforced, as you said, that he is the incoming president. But I think Trump can counter that by aggressive actions as president to show that he's the president. And I'm very encouraged that he's planning new sanctions against Iran and new sanctions against China. And I'm even thrilled that there's been speculation that they could be of such a nature that they really could not be practically reversed. And I think that he needs to do more of that. And I think it's a question of getting his act together and taking it on the road. And I've been encouraging that vigorously, as has Mark Meadows, his chief of staff.
I'm glad you were talking to him before the election and after. I have to say, though, I was unimpressed, quite frankly, with some members of his team, without naming names, but the publicly available names, you know, like the top campaign leadership. Very, very run-of-the-mill people, ordinary kind of folks, just political mechanics. And I wondered if he would have been better off like he did 16, which he was really driving the show for most of it. Maybe he was this time as well, and these people were there in name only. But any thoughts on, well, that's just an observation. Tell me this, what was it like talking with the president, hundreds of calls? Is there anything, without divulging any confidence or whatever, violating, what is it about him that people would not expect?
He's a very nice guy. I have a close tie with him because my father was his lawyer and represented him on Trump Tower and a number of other cases. And he constantly is talking to me about how great my father was. And he also, Roy Cohn, who's kind of his mentor, is my first cousin once removed. So I'm sort of a member of the extended family in a sense, at least in my view and his view. At one point, and my father was also his father's lawyer. At one point, I told the president, I think that your father and my father are looking down on us from heaven and approving of what we're doing together. So there was a warmth there. Eileen and I were both on the calls, my wife. Most of the time we spoke by speakerphone, and he would always sign off. It was so sweet. He would say, well, goodbye, kids. Talk to you tomorrow.
Huh.
And he'd do things like saying, how are you? How's everything? How's your marriage? Stuff like that. He was just a very, very warm, kind, nice guy. And I've always found him that way. It's the media image that he's a volcanic personality. But let me comment on what you said earlier. I don't want to get into the blame game in terms of the staff, because
sure,
they all did their best. But and there was no disloyalty. Actually remarkably absence of leaks. But I do believe that Donald Trump ran this campaign. He didn't run the field operation that had one person running it, and they may have overspent a little bit. He didn't actually write the media. Other people did that. But the campaign was not the – when you look at the silos of a campaign, field operation, advertising, and candidate speaking, and executive actions and legislation as president – the latter two completely dominated the first two. We were spent 2-1 in paid media, but it didn't make a hell of a lot of difference. And our field organization was probably pretty good, but you couldn't tell after the theft. But, you know, the real campaign was Donald Trump's message and these rallies and what he said at each of them. One of the top people in the Trump campaign told me, well, I think I can name him, Jared Kushner said, the president doesn't follow polls, he makes polls.
Hmm.
And what he meant by that is that he changes the lay of the land. He doesn't just survey it. And clearly this campaign was Donald Trump's campaign, and it was his personality. I think in a sense more so than in 16, because in 16 the dominant force in shaping the campaign was Hillary Clinton's screw-ups. And Donald Trump's positioning was very important, but it took second place to the email controversy and all the other Benghazi and all the other nonsense about Hillary Clinton. So I think that was a big difference in this case.
When I look at Joe Biden and how he campaigned or did not campaign, I found it very suspicious. I said so out loud, like, what is this guy thinking and doing? And do you think that just his lack of activity suggested a knowledge of how this system may have been rigged ahead of time in his favor? Or is it more traditional, like, okay, we want to make this a referendum on Donald Trump, so we don't want to skyline ourselves because that incurs risk?
I think he certainly knew about all of this and was in on the planning of it. He would have had to have been. But I believe the main motive for his lack of campaigning is that he's half dead. and they can't put him out there, because every time they put him out there, he screws it up, he stumbles, he adds to the case that he shouldn't be president, that he's not mentally able to do it, and he was forced to have limited exposure because he was so bad every time he was exposed.
So that's fascinating stuff, by the way. And you're not a lawyer, are you?
No, I am the son of one and the husband of one, so I might as well be.
But. Yeah, you've obviously, it sounds like you are. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York City, in Manhattan, on 85th Street and West End Avenue. And I was because it comes with the water you drink there, I was a liberal Democrat. And I went to Stuyvesant High School. That's a very special, wonderful school. You have to take a test to get in. And there I met I organized really a bunch of kids, my fellow students. And we were called, and we were in the debating team, and we won all kinds of awards. And then most of us went to Columbia together. We all got in, thankfully, and we stayed organized and in touch. And we decided to move our operation to the West Side for politics. And one of our people, Jerry Nadler, came from Brooklyn. Another, the assemblyman, Dick Gottfried, came from Queens. But I lived on the West Side, and Columbia was on the West Side. So we sunk our roots there.
Was Ickes in your group?
No, he was my biggest enemy. I'll say about that in a minute. The But we in 1969, when we all turned 21, we ran for district leader of the Democratic Party in on the whole West Side, and we challenged the incumbent district leaders. Some of them were old, long-time fogies who'd been there forever, but some of them were reform Democrats who were sort of modern, new, and somewhat younger. Ickes was one of those. And we took them all on, and we defeated all of them. A bunch of 21-year-olds defeated a bunch of 30, 40, and 50, and 60-year-olds. And it sent shockwaves throughout the Democratic Party. And that organization that I helped set up is still there, still runs that area. And Nadler is still the congressman, and Gottfried is still the assemblyman. And I was heavily, heavily involved in that. Then I began to work nationally.
Hey, Dick, real quick, I'm just curious one thing. Why did you, look, you grew up in Manhattan, you went to high school in Manhattan, obviously, and you went to college in Manhattan, and I think you came from, relatively comfortable background economically. Why didn't you leave the city? Why did you go to Columbia?
Well, I went to Columbia to stay in the city.
Yeah, well, I mean, like a
I
lot of kids
was.
want to, get away from home, that kind of thing.
No. I actually moved out, but my political career, it was very far along, but even by the time I was 21.
Can I ask you real quick, what did you major in at Columbia?
Government politics. Yeah.
And you were a good student, obviously from Stuyvesant, and you got into the Ivy
Yeah.
League. You aced Columbia.
I was, but I wasn't. I didn't pay much attention to Columbia. I cut a lot of classes, and I spent my full time working in politics.
Did you have
And
siblings?
no.
And your father, by the way, were you aware as a kid that he was, associated with Fred Trump? Was Fred Trump famous enough that did you ever meet him?
Well, I never met Fred, but when Eileen and I were first dating in 1975, we had dinner with Donald and Ivanka Trump and with my parents at their house. And that was the first time I think I met Donald. But
What did you think of him? Do you
I
remember
liked
that?
him. I thought I was kind of a he was kind of a tycoon, and really it made no particular impression on me one way or the other. I can't say that a romance was born. After that, we began to work together quite a bit, and the relationship really deepened and grew. I decided in the early 70s to begin to go national and work for candidates around the country to make a living as a political consultant. And my first client was Bill Clinton, who was the governor of Arkansas. And as you said, I helped him get elected governor. And then he fired me the first year.
So let's go back. Wait. So you met him, I guess he was attorney general wanting to be
Yeah.
governor, right?
Right. He was 31 and I was 30.
And it's interesting, he like four of the last five presidents or something, he lost his first bid for Congress. Right? He ran for Congress and he lost. That was his first outing.
Right.
But he was definitely attorney general when you met him.
Yeah, but it was an easy race to become attorney general. Very few
Sure.
people really opposed him. And even when he got elected governor, that wasn't the main race in the state. Everybody was focused on the Senate race that his ally David Pryor won. But the rubber hit the road in 1980 when he ran for re-election. Governors had only 2-year terms back then in Arkansas. And he was opposed by the strong Republican candidate named Frank White, who beat him. It's shocking everybody in the state and many people in the country. And he had fired me the year before he lost. So he tended to kick himself for that. And right as he was losing the election night, Hillary called me and said, "You gotta come back and save us." And I said, "Hillary, I'm exhausted. I just finished a whole bunch of campaigns." I said, "No, get on a plane and come right down here." And I did, and I really piloted him to getting back in. And then I ran all of his campaigns throughout the 80s.
By the way, you came when Hillary called you, talked to him. He was still governor. He was the lame duck governor leaving office,
Right,
right? And you, I
right.
think I read this in some book, but you sat with him in the kitchen of the governor's mansion and you kind of mapped out a way to come back for him.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, it was a controversial way. I don't know if you have time for these ramblings, but I told him you have to apologize. You have to open your campaign with an apology. My polling showed that the voters didn't want him to lose. They wanted to teach him a lesson. because he raised car tag fees, and nobody thought that was significant. It was just $17 extra a year. But it had been frozen at that level for a long time, and the voters really resented the hell out of it. So I urged him to apologize. And then he did something wonderful. He wouldn't apologize. He never apologizes, ever, ever, ever. But he did walk into the studio and tell the guy to start the camera. And I said, should I read the script? And he said, no, you'll like what I'm going to say. And then he said, one of the most famous spots of all time, he said, before I run for governor this time, I'd like to talk to you about what I did last time. I promised to fix your roads. And to get money to do that, I raised your car tag fees. But you resented me and you voted me out of office because of it. Well, when I was coming up, my daddy never had to whip me twice for the same thing. And I got to tell you, if you reelect, you elect me governor again, I'll never, ever raise your car tag fees. And it was very effective. And the Arkansas newspapers depicted him as a monk in sackcloth and ashes for the rest of the campaign. And but it really resonated with the voters.
I saw that spot at some point. Listen, can I ask you, though, when you first teamed up with him, look, a guy who's 32 becomes governor or could become governor. When did you see this guy as a potential future president of the United States? I could see potentially having been around like right away, right?
Immediately. Yeah. In fact, I was with Hillary in 1982. And we were sitting in the car and Bill was speaking. And I said, you know, this guy can be president. And she said, well, we got to get him back in as governor first. And I said, yeah, but he has the star power to be president. And then I called, when I first met Clinton in 1978, I called Eileen and said, I just met a guy who could be president. It's the only time I've ever said that.
You know, it's interesting. I remember the night he was elected, and I remember Frank Reynolds on ABC News saying that this could be a future president. He's only 32. Yeah. I was probably in fourth grade. And you know what, I actually resented it. I resented that somebody so young could be anointed or talked about like that. And I wonder, because let's face it, Republicans his age gave him a hard time later. And I think a lot of it was based on jealousy and all kinds of personal animus.
Well, he always felt that. Once Hillary told me, you know why the media hates us? They hate us because they're jealous of us. We're the same age as they are, and we're president and they're not.
There's a lot to that.
Anyway, so I became a Republican as I began working with Clinton over the 1980s, and I was seeing him each week in Arkansas. He and I began to look at the debris of the Carter administration, the failure of the Mondale campaign, and we came jointly, I guess, to the conclusion that the Democratic Party had to change and that it couldn't be simply a party of giving out goodies. And together in our discussions, we came up with the notion of a new social contract. We give you opportunity and you assume responsibility. We'll pay for your tuition, but you have to go into public service. We'll give you welfare, but you have to work and have a time limit on benefits. The transaction of opportunity for responsibility. And that became the core, really, of Clinton's message. Throughout the early days as he ran for president.
Is this the underpinnings of the DLC? Is that what you're building?
Yes, here? Yes. Yeah. It led to the creation of the Democratic Leadership Committee, Clinton's kind of arm.
So just overall, can I ask you this? You, look, obviously you've been highly critical of the Clintons as of late, or maybe for the past 20 years or so.
Yeah.
But you know, you spent quality time with them, and I'm one. You've got to have some warm feelings for them as well, or is it totally bad blood now? How would you describe it? Your view of them, and you know, go ahead.
I do feel, and I always felt positive about Bill Clinton, and that's never changed. My view of Hillary changed dramatically as I got to see her tactics during the 1992 presidential campaign. Bill's affairs and sexcapades never amounted to much in Arkansas. Nobody ever raised the issue and the media wouldn't carry it. But in 92, they dominated his presidential race with Jennifer Flowers. And I saw how Hillary organized these detectives into what I called the secret police, who she had Betsy Wright, the chief of staff, sit down with Bill and say, okay, give me a list of all the women. And he would he would lie, and then she'd say, what about this one? What about that one? What about that one? And eventually she probably put him on the rack and got all of the women. And then they assigned detectives to go out and meet with every one of them, dig up dirt on their past, threaten them, bribe them, offer them opportunities, all kinds of things, threats, opportunities, blackmail, coercion, the secret police. And Hillary ran every inch of that. And I just thought this was absolutely absurd. This was obscene. And I spoke out against it at the time. And have not at the time, 92, I didn't. He was still running for president. But it really came out in detail in 96 and 95, 96. And I've always blamed Hillary for that. And I've never liked her for that. So our relationship personally was very embittered.
By the way, are we talking about scores of women, dozens of women? How many women, you know, were
well,
on
I'll
that
tell you
list?
Something. When I was on Fox News, Paula Zahn was interviewing me, and she said the story was that the women who complained about Bill Clinton were being audited by the IRS. And I said, well, how many you got? And she ticked off six names. I said, well, six names, that's about, out of a couple of hundred, that's about 2 or 3%. That's about the ratio of the population.
Oh, geez. Well, look, with that, if he's a guy with appetites, obviously, did you up close, did it, and I'm not judging anybody here, but I'm just curious, do you think it took away from his governing, from his responsibilities, doing all that stuff? Did it, well, was it a distraction for him? It had to be, probably, right?
It obliterated his second term.
No, I'm talking about when he was governor and you're around
governor,
him and stuff.
No.
Like, yeah.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Forget about the media. I'm just saying, like, the practicality of, you know, all these hookups every day or every other day or once a week. You know, you can't be worried too much about Arkansas when you're hooking up with Jennifer Flowers. I mean, was that an issue?
I think you overestimate Jennifer, but but no, it was not an issue. And he just went on. Back then was a sort of assumed that politicians have their private life and do whatever they want. People knew that John Kennedy screwed around, and there was almost a sort of romantic feeling of noblesse oblige. That changed dramatically, but not while he was governor.
So you say, obviously, your relationship with Hillary Clinton, that's irreparably, that's bad, that's gone. What about Bill? Have you talked to him over the past couple of years?
Hillary still sends me a Christmas card every year, but there's white powder on the outside of the envelope, so I never open it.
What about President Clinton? Do you ever talk to him?
Well, I haven't spoken with him in 10 or 15 years, and even then was just meeting at an event. We really had our last important conversation in 1997. He called me the minute Monica Lewinsky story broke and asked me for advice. And I was out of the campaign at that point. And I think the thing you have to watch is the cover-up. That's what Nixon got impeached for, not the sex. And he said, so what should I do? And I said, I think you want to tell the truth. He said, do you think I can get away with that? And I said, well, let me poll it. And first I said, what did you do? And he said, I didn't do what they said I did, but I may have done so much that I can't prove my innocence. I had no idea that that was oral sex as opposed to intercourse, but I didn't ask. And I conducted a poll, and I came back to him, and I said, they will accept the adultery, but they will not accept lying. So don't lie. And he said, how do I handle it? And I said, deftly, softly, soft hands, I said, using a baseball phrase. Don't be out there in a strident denial. Let people acclimate to the concept. You think there is no relationship when they're not saying there wasn't one is a good line. Use that stuff and don't do a lot of interviews. And then 2 days later, I see him on the platform saying, I did not have sex with that woman, Monica Lewinsky, and so on, the exact opposite of what I thought he should do. And I believe, and the next morning, Hillary went on Good Morning America and said, there's a vast right-wing conspiracy that is framing my husband. And I think what happened, I don't know this, but I speculate, that he went home to her and she said, look, if you don't deny this, I'm not going to defend you, because if you're tolerating that it could be true, I can't be out there defending you. what people never got was that Hillary's power came from her marriage. She wasn't elected first lady. And if the marriage turned out to be a fraud, so was she. And so is the roots of her power.
Wow. Wow. You know what? So, when he made that denial, though, if I may, like he said, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. Like now, sexual relations, the word sex, sexual,
yeah.
I believe
well, he
connotes.
Was hanging it on a technicality.
Right. That's a reproductive act. And oral sex, technically speaking, is not a reproductive act. Is that what he was hanging it on?
Yeah, it was. And Bill was always quite precise in his language because he's a pretty good lawyer. And, but that wouldn't fly with public opinion, and it did. But the concept, but Hillary needed him to lie, and the fundamental error of the Clinton handling of that was his lie.
Wow. So when you see him now, and he's not very high profile these days.
Well, he's hiding under a table because of Jeffrey Epstein.
So what? There's a lot there.
Yeah, I think there is. I don't know that for a fact, but I assume there is.
You think Epstein? You think Epstein killed himself or was murdered?
I have no idea, and but I think that I think Clinton doesn't want to come out in this environment and be very public, and I think Hillary seconded that. I think Hillary wanted to be appointed to a job by Biden, and I think she expected it when Biden quote won. But then when the Republicans took the Senate, she realized she'd have to be confirmed for any important job like UN ambassador. And she was not going to go through a confirmation hearing. So there's going to be no appointment.
One last thing. What do you think of who's next? Any predictions on who's coming down the pike? Let's say for a moment that that Donald Trump is reelected. Who's a hot commodity? Who's somebody to keep your eye on, both on the Republican side and the Democrat side?
Well, on the let's just start with looking at the year anyway. I think that there's a very good chance that if Trump is not elected this time, he will run in 24. And I think he'll probably clean out the whole Republican field. I think he'll basically say, I want a rematch, and nobody else will be able to really contest that. His hold over the base is so strong. If Trump does not run, or Trump is defeated, and Biden is president, then I think you'll have a large group of candidates. My personal favorite among that group would be Ted Cruz, but I think you're also going to see Nikki Haley. You might see Donald Trump Jr. You'll certainly see Mike Pence. You'll probably see some fringe characters that could become center stage, like Tom Cotton or Josh Hawley. As I say, Nikki Haley, yeah. So it'll be a real free-for-all, like it was in 2016.
You know history very well. You obviously know what's happening right now. I have a last question. Is there anything to be said for an older man really should hold the job? Donald Trump is the oldest president or one of that we've ever had. And I think there's something that is very natural and makes sense about that because you've already made your name. You've already made your money. You are now in a position to give back to the country. When Obama was going, when he was president, I think on some level you're designed primarily to think about your family first. And I think Clinton obviously had all kinds of things to think about his post-presidency, how he would make money. You almost can't put the country first when you're a young person. Does that make sense? I like Ted Cruz a lot too, but with this in mind, I think he's too young. I want to see older people. I think they're the ones who are ready to put country first.
I don't agree with you, Greg. I can see the point, but being president is a very, very demanding and taxing job. It takes an enormous amount of energy. And the most interesting thing about it is that it takes no energy to go along. The presidency is pre-scripted. The bureaucracy knows just what it wants to do. Every party has its program. Its congressional majority knows what it wants. And if you want, all you have to do is sit back there and go to sleep and it'll take you along. And nobody will know that you're not really running things like a civil service. But if you want to change it, you want to change direction, it takes a decisive, aggressive act of intervention that takes a vast amount of energy and a vast persistence. Just look at Donald Trump. And while Trump certainly is an exhibit of how you can have that energy in the 70s, I think you need a younger, more energetic man most of the time.
That's wild, though. The presidency is designed, it's almost president-proof, I once heard. It just kind of keeps going on its own.
Yeah, it's like the British and German and Japanese civil service systems, which where the civil servants really run the country. And in the U.S., they have much less power and the president much more power. But there is still always a tendency to go along with what's always been done. And when you do something that's out of the ordinary, even minor things, like once I wrote a speech for Clinton on Memorial Day, where I talked about identifying an axis of, I didn't call it the axis of evil, I called it the rogue states, by going after Iraq and Iran and that stuff. And the Pentagon came over to me and said, we are not taking any draft from you of a Memorial Day speech. We write that speech. It is a traditional speech that the president gives without inciting controversy, simply celebrating America's heritage. And I said, yeah, but he's got to get reelected. And they said, that is none of our concern. Basically, get lost. And that kind of thing happens all the time. If you want to change something, you really have to go out there and push it and push it and push it.
Wow. Love it. Dick Morris, thank you very, very much. Please, everybody, check out dickmorris.com, and you'll see Dick on Newsmax again very, very soon. Dick, so appreciated. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Greg.
Okay. All right. That was Dick Morris. Pretty cool. And sorry I kept him on the phone so long. Folks, one more time, if you don't mind, would love to have you subscribe to the show. It actually helps me and my producer, Maya Zumwalt, quite a bit. Just go and click subscribe, and you can download the show as well. It's free, of course, as you know, and the reviews, if you make one, I will read it, I will get it, and they're usually quite fun to read. So subscribe, download, review, and rate, and many, many thanks. I'm at Greg Kelly USA, and check it out, actually, dickmorris.com. He's talking about stuff that no one else is talking about, but it's important stuff, and usually you will be talking about it or hearing about it down the road. And all right, folks, we will talk soon, to be continued.